This podcast is brought to you by Recontract, the leading software to automate your reconditioning process and streamline your entire used vehicle management process. Visit recontract.com to learn more. That's recontract.com.
Want to dive deeper into the topics you hear about on Daily Drive? We're offering listeners a special offer, 20% off a one-year Automotive News digital subscription. That gets you access to all of our news, information, and analysis made for automotive industry leaders like you. Go to autonews.com/dailydrivepromo to redeem. Welcome to this weekend drive edition of Daily Drive for the fourth week in March 2024. I'm Jamie Butters, executive editor of Automotive News in Detroit.
And I'm Kellen Walker in Las Vegas. Today, we're breaking down some of the biggest stories in the auto industry from the past week and looking forward to what's in store in the days ahead. In a bit, we'll talk about the promising and concerning trends for electrification with our own Hannah Lutz.
It's difficult to force some of this with regulation. The industry just isn't quite ready, and consumers aren't really ready. There's still a lot of education that needs to take place for those kind of numbers.
That's coming up in minutes, but first, Jamie, how you doing?
All right, Kel, how are you?
Good, man. Let's get into some news. So, franchise dealers' outlook on used vehicle sales is still at its lowest point since the pandemic. That's according to the Cox Automotive Dealer Sentiment Index for the first quarter. Do you think that the industry's focus on the EV transition made the industry lose focus on the used vehicle market? And are we still some years out before we see that market rebound?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, people in used vehicles always feel like they don't get enough attention. You know, the market for used vehicles is like 2 to 3 times as big as for new. But, you know, we mostly cover the biggest companies, the automakers. So they are not in the used car business and they're putting billions of dollars into EVs. So that kind of does steal a lot of the attention. The used vehicles, you know, are really important to dealership operations. But it's still struggling really with the aftermath of the pandemic. We've seen some forecasts, you know, for the second half of this year, the number of vehicles returning from leases is going to fall dramatically. When production was down during the second year really of the pandemic, that meant everybody pulled back on lease incentives because every car they had, they could sell for above sticker price. There's just not much that's going to be available in the 1 to 3 year old, you know, sort of used vehicle market. So it could take several more years to work that through.
And when you say several, 5 to 10, seven to 10.
Yeah, probably at least 5, you know.
Wow.
But at least, you know, at least 3 more years from now. And even then you're looking at the middle aged used vehicles. So really a 5 to 10 kind of window before things fully normalize. If there's no other, you know, catastrophes that mess with the whole vehicle production system worldwide.
Right. Well, also, Jamie, this week you spoke with our own Michael Martinez about the VW Chattanooga assembly plant seeking an election to unionize. It's getting close and it looks like they may get their wish. You and Mike agreed that the next plant on the UAW's radar could be the Mercedes assembly plant in Alabama.
They're already at 50% of workers signing cards in support of the union. So they're getting close to that 70% number that would trigger an election. If they can win in Chattanooga, I would think maybe Mercedes might be the next opportunity.
Now, if the UAW gets both of these plants, does this solidify Sean Fain's legacy? Everything he's done from how he won the election to pretty much how transparent he's been, and he got a sitting president to show up on the picket line. Will he be looked at as the greatest UAW president since Walter Reuther?
He might already be, you know, but if he can win even one of those plants, it elevates him to a new level and may set up a much longer run for his presidency than just these 4 years that he's been elected to so far. Coming out of the scandals at the UAW, you know, the union seemed very weak. Now it seems really energized, got those really strong contracts, got a lot of engagement during the strike. If they can pull off even VW, that would be something that's really unprecedented for this union and a huge win for him. If he can get another one or two after that, he might be rivaling Mr. Ruther for greatest of all time.
I mean, folks can say what they want about Sean Fain and how he's gone about, you know, his tactics and how he's just gone about everything. But I mean, he's getting the job done.
Well, and not to keep repeating myself, but since we're stepping back and putting context on it, you know, you have to remember that he came in having barely won, you know, a thinly attended election. He had, you know, no base, no machine, and no mandate. And he really went about building that within the UAW community and even the broader labor movement, and has really done an amazing job, at least, you know, as a politician. Whatever you think of his objectives, he has executed on them really effectively.
I agree. Lastly, Jamie, have you got any feedback about Automotive News reclassifying Tesla as non-luxury?
Yes, quite a bit. By, you know, email, texts from friends in the industry, and all the social media platforms. It's like everybody has an opinion on this.
Well, we got an email, which, by the way, if you want to send us your email and, you know, have your comments, you can email us at dailydrive@autonews.com. But this email comes from a gentleman by the name of Martin. And Martin says that Tesla has always been non-luxury. He states it's just a car with a lot of features, no different than a fully loaded Corolla or Focus. Teslas are plain, space age, and industrial in appearance. Nothing says luxury in any way. It does, however, say nice. It doesn't say expensive. It does say, welcome to my laboratory, Mr. Bond. Jamie, what are your thoughts on Mr. Martin's email?
Yeah, well, like the dude would say, you know, that's just like your opinion, man. But it's fine. Everybody gets to have their opinion, especially about design. You know, the Tesla design was very polarizing. To some people, it was like so Spartan, minimalist, and plain that it had spoke to them as a non-luxury experience. But to other people, you know, it was clean and elegant, you know, space age perhaps, you know, that's futuristic and maybe an extreme Scandinavian sort of aesthetic. A lot of people found it very appealing. So the design was sort of polarizing. For us, you know, the reason we categorized it as luxury is because whether Martin thinks the price or that it looks expensive or says expensive, it was expensive. The Roadster was expensive. The Model S was expensive. The X was expensive. So it clearly started out, you know, starting out in the six-figure range. Even when the 3 and the Y came out, you know, they were still $50,000, $60,000 vehicles, not the sort of mainstream vehicles they were originally billed as. But then last year they brought the prices down, and now, you know, no longer classify them as luxury. Their key products are really in the heart of the market. But I also heard from people on social media and other places saying, you know, well, it's still luxury to me. It's luxury if the people who buy it feel like it's luxury, and can't argue with that either.
Everyone has an opinion. Coming up, we'll talk about the flurry of news this week surrounding electrification and the evolving state of EV demand. That's next on Weekend Drive.
Tesla is no longer a luxury brand. At least that's what we've decided here at Automotive News, but we want to hear from you.
What do you think of our decision to no longer classify Tesla as luxury in our coverage? Send us a voicemail, text, or email. You might hear your comment on this week's Weekend Drive episode. Here's how to get in touch.
Call us and leave a voicemail or text us at 313-444-2774. Again, that's 313-444-2774. You can also record your voice on your smartphone and send it to dailydrive@autonews.com. That's dailydrive, one word, at autonews.com.
And tune into our Weekend Drive episode this weekend, available Saturday morning.
Managing your used inventory is not exclusive to one person or one part of the dealership. What does the communication look like between sales and service? Are your vehicles getting passed from trade-in to recon with no hiccups? What is your average cycle time to get a used car frontline ready? There is a lot to keep track of all at once. Right now, you could be experiencing 3 major issues with your recon information causing process breakdowns. 1, lack of visibility into recon pricing to inform the appraisal process. 2, no access to that appraisal information when working through recon approvals. 3, missed information and process bottlenecks trying to manage a vehicle across multiple systems and tools. Full insight throughout your entire process is crucial to making your used car department the most efficient and profitable it can be. Recontract, combined with AutoVision, creates an end-to-end tool for your used car department to address these breakdowns. With access to live appraisal information and reconditioning approvals, you get a single view of every vehicle with all the data you need right in one place. Make more educated decisions on your used car inventory faster with all your data easily accessible at any stage. Visit info.recontract.com/autovision for more information. That's info.recontract.com/autovision.
Welcome back to Weekend Drive. I'm Jamie Butters with Kellen Walker. It's been a week of developments on the electrification front. The EPA finalized its emissions rules, giving automakers more time and flexibility in their EV transitions. A new study from Boston Consulting Group outlined big promises and significant challenges for EV adoption. And longtime rivals Honda and Nissan look like they're teaming up to help make their battery-powered cars and trucks profitable. To help unpack all these stories, I'm here with Automotive News electrification reporter, Hannah Lutz. Hannah Lutz, welcome back to Weekend Drive.
Hi, Jamie. Nice to be here.
There's been a lot going on in the EV world, and I just wanted to kind of catch up on it and see if we can piece it all together into something meaningful or at least just note it all. So the first big news of this week really was the finalizing of the EPA's emissions rule. Kind of less demanding in the short term, but pushes some bigger increases farther out into the 2030s. What did you think about that? What did you hear people say about it?
Well, I think it showed that the EPA was listening. The EPA was listening to the industry. There was a lot of feedback they got from automakers and dealers saying that the initial proposal of the rule was too stringent, too aggressive. So this shows that they took that into consideration, and it's much less aggressive in the near term, but it still holds on to some of these goals long term.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to go easy on the industry in the short term, given the inadequacy of the charging infrastructure and the infancy of the domestic battery supply chain. We still have pretty limited selection of vehicles. They still are pretty pricey, and we know automakers are working on much cheaper EVs that they can hopefully bring out before the end of the decade. And maybe then the sales will naturally rise to 40, 50, 60%.
Right. It's difficult to force some of this with regulation because of all the points you just made. The industry just isn't quite ready to hit that number of the 67%. And consumers aren't really ready. There's still a lot of education that needs to take place for those kind of numbers.
You're absolutely right that the regulators listen to the industry, but some of the folks are still not really happy with it. The dealers are saying, you know, they're asking for things that we can't possibly serve today. And it's like, well, of course you can't do it today. But it's going to be a different world. We'll have a lot more chargers, hopefully, and a lot better running chargers, more reliable chargers out there by the end of the decade, as well as a lot cheaper vehicles to choose from. So buys them a little time. Now it's up to the automakers and the battery companies and everybody else to get all the pieces in place.
Right. And it's an emissions rule. So a lot of that will come from EV sales, but it can come from other places too. From hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and you know, more efficient internal combustion vehicles. So there's room. There's room here.
Yeah. Well, and so along those lines, I think you're absolutely right. The customers aren't really ready. In a lot of parts of the country, it isn't really convenient, especially if you're a one-car family. Even if you had your own charger at home, you might feel vulnerable about it. But a recent study from Boston Consulting Group said like almost 40% of new car buyers say they would buy an EV as their next car if it met all their demands, if they could find charging quickly enough, if it was a 20-minute charge, if it cost $50,000 or less and had, a 350-mile range. That's kind of a big ask, but it's kind of within reach. It's almost within reach of a lot of automakers.
Yeah. So today, the only EV that meets that is the IONIQ 6, the Hyundai IONIQ 6. But as these next generation EVs roll out in the next 12 to 18 months, more EVs will meet those standards. But, you know, for now, it is tricky because you have this almost 40% of people surveyed said that they did plan to buy an EV, but, you know, they also said it should meet these thresholds. So it's not like the 40% will buy an EV. That's what makes it tricky. And BCG told me when we talked that the early adopters of EVs were more willing to compromise because they really care about the environment and the impact they're making on the planet by driving an EV. So they might spend more than they would normally to drive an EV. Mm-hmm. They might be okay with a shorter range than they would get on a gas vehicle. But this next wave of adopters, the current wave, these like EV intenders that we're talking about, they are not as willing to make these sacrifices. They want what they already have in their gas vehicle. So that's what the automakers really have to sell them on. And with the IONIQ 6 is the only option right now, it's limited.
I'm a big fan of the IONIQ 6. Not everyone loves that style. I think it looks really cool, but it's definitely a challenge. And when you get to that mass market, I think that's absolutely right on, right? The mass market will switch to EVs when they make better economic sense for them, when it's going to make their life better than buying, you know, another Corolla or another, you know, F-150. And that's, you know, kind of where the industry is trying to go, right? Tesla, Kia, Ford, Stellantis, I'm sure the others are working on cheaper EVs as well. You know, if they can come out with something in the $25,000 to $30,000 range, given they sell hardly anything at that price today, I think a lot of people would make the switch, right? If it's cheaper and it's quiet and clean and the maintenance costs are less, that makes it a no-brainer. Right now, it's a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and with charging too, one of the thresholds in that survey was they wanted a 30-minute time to like reach a charger, basically. So that includes the time it takes to get off the highway or wherever you are, get to the charger, and then wait for the charger. So to me, I thought 30 minutes was kind of a long time. I don't think I would be willing to wait 30 minutes. So I thought that was actually very generous. But yeah, they want that time, and that is not guaranteed yet. The charging infrastructure is being built out, but it's not quite where they want it to be.
The other issue BCG really highlighted was the challenge, you know, not only to meet consumer demands, but, you know, shareholder demands, to the bottom line demands, that they're really roughly on average losing like $6,000 per vehicle. I know, you know, Hyundai and Stellantis say they make money on their EVs. I think they mean sort of the marginal costs. They're able to sell them for what it costs to make them. That probably doesn't cover the massive investments up front to build the plants and design the cars and all that. So I think sort of that's probably why BCG's analysis differs from what some of the companies say about themselves. But it's a big hurdle.
Yeah, it is. And there, you know, there's an asterisk there. It's $6,000 on a $50,000 EV after accounting for tax credits. And that's for most automakers. So I think there are some automakers that are more profitable than others. But yeah, that's a huge gap. $6,000 on every single vehicle. That is a big deal. And BCG outlined some ways that automakers can help narrow that gap, like efficiencies in the manufacturing process, better batteries, things like that. But that still only closed like half of the gap, only $3,000. So to make up for that other $3,000, they have to lean on friendly policies for them and a stronger charging infrastructure. And BCG also talked about alliances coming together to share some of those EV costs.
Yeah, we've seen a number of those recently. You know, Honda and Nissan a little over a week ago announced they were going to work together on EV components. We just have a story that just moved late this week about Nissan also partnering with Mitsubishi, not necessarily Mitsubishi Motors, but the parent company, trying to help it lower costs on EV development. And then we just broke some other news on Honda cutting dealers' margins, and at least the excuse for it, or the rationale that was given, I should say, is the high cost of EV investments that company has to make. So there's two Japanese companies, you know, really making some moves all about trying to bring their EV business into profitability.
Yeah, when you look at the BCG number, the $6,000, I mean, it makes sense. They've got to make some tough decisions where they can. And Honda obviously is starting to look at what they're giving the dealers, cutting that back. Maybe they'll look elsewhere too.
Yeah, one analyst we spoke with said, hey, if this is happening at Honda, you're going to see it at all the other brands, and you're going to see them not only squeezing their dealers, but squeezing their suppliers. Like you said, I mean, $6,000, I mean, that's a negative 12% profit margin. The auto industry, you know, traditionally has had maybe 5% profit margins on new vehicles. During really healthy times, they've gone up to like 10%. And on some of the adjusted levels, that's what they're all aiming for. But you think about a negative 12%, I mean, that means they've got whatever, 17, 20% improvement they need to make. Really big ask.
Yeah. And I mean, BCG was asking, like, can they stomach this? Can they continue on this path of losing money on EVs? It really doesn't seem like it. And I don't know what the solution is, but I know some of the biggest automakers said they need to lean on their most profitable SUVs and pickups that run on gas. And I mean, if that is necessary to continue, it kind of sets the industry back on these EV targets.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that cutting back and not wanting to take so many losses is definitely part of what was going on at GM and Ford as they grappled with the less robust than forecast demand for EVs. So, you know, trying to get to where maybe they can improve the battery chemistry. Ford's trying to build that get that LFP battery plant built in Michigan, which, you know, maybe wouldn't charge as fast, but would be a lot lower cost, give them some more flexibility coming to the market. So I think it all has to be about the battery. I mean, they want to get the savings they can from the dealers, from all the components, but, you know, we're going to have better batteries. You know, maybe it's more like the solid state or semi-solid state later in the decade when the industry really gets fixed.
Right. And LFP is a great solution. So I'll be curious to see how Ford does with that, because the LFP batteries should meet most consumers' needs on a daily basis or a weekly basis. The solid state batteries are super high tech and will be very impressive whenever they do reach the market, but it seems like more of sort of a luxury offering.
Yeah, and a lot further down the road to get any decent production out of that.
Right.
Well, there's so much more that's going to happen this year. I'm sure we'll have you back on Weekend Drive as well as Daily Drive. Hannah Lutz covers electrification for us at Automotive News. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
That's all for this Weekend Drive edition of Daily Drive. I'm Jamie Butters.
And I'm Kellen Walker. Thanks to Automotive News coordinating producer Jake Neer for his help on today's podcast. You can get the latest news on electrification, used vehicle sales, and everything happening in the auto industry at autonews.com.
Come back on Monday for a conversation with Michigan's Chief Mobility Officer, Justine Johnson, about how the state hopes to become a hub of mobility.
This is a consortium of states in the Midwest that have agreed to making sure that there's this contiguous network of EV charging infrastructure. And it's that type of partnership that I think is really important.
We'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the show and the topics we covered today. Send us an email at dailydrive@autonews.com or leave us a voicemail at 313-444-2774. If you enjoy the podcast, remember to like, leave a review, and subscribe so you never miss an episode.